This message comes from NPR sponsor, the official Jinx podcast from HBO. The HBO original documentary series, The Jinx, returns for part two on Max as the filmmakers untangle the web of Robert Durst's crimes. Listen to the official Jinx podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the new film, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, Tom Cruise is back as super spy Ethan Hunt. This time, he has to get his hands on two halves of a complex key that somehow has the power to defeat an all-powerful AI known as the Entity. You'll see plenty of familiar faces as well as some new ones, most interestingly, Hayley Atwell. And yes, Tom Cruise still does a lot of his own stunts. I'm Linda Holmes, and today on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're talking about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Joining me today is Weilin Wong. She's the co-host of NPR's daily economics podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. Hey, Weilin.
Hi, Linda.
And also here with us is Vulture TV critic Roxana Haddadi. Welcome back, Roxana.
Thank you.
And rounding out the panel is writer and host of the imminent Smithsonian Magazine podcast, There's More to That. You know, not for nothing, our longstanding action and punching correspondent, Chris Clement. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Linda. You know, Alec Baldwin once said I was the living manifestation of destiny. So if you'd like to introduce me that way in the future.
I'll do it next time. So the Mission Impossible series has made billions of dollars since its debut in 1996. Tom Cruise plays Ethan Hunt, who battles various enemies with the help of his team at the Impossible Mission Force. The latest and seventh movie is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which is a very ungainly name for a movie, but which signals that this is, in fact, the first half of a two-part story intended to conclude next summer. The story involves a godlike AI known as the Entity, which can go anywhere and do anything. It's probably recording this podcast right now. A godlike AI is obviously difficult to engage in the excitement of hand-to-hand combat, so Ethan also has to fight an antagonist named Gabriel, played by Isai Morales. Gabriel is an old nemesis of Ethan's, connected to his very long history of seeing women who adore him get murdered. But Gabriel's association with the Entity makes him extra menacing. Hayley Atwell joins the franchise as a spellbinding pickpocket named Grace, and Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, and Rebecca Ferguson are back as members of Ethan's team. The story has chases, peril, explosions, and a whole bunch of fun things Tom Cruise apparently wanted to do, including motorcycle stunts and close-up magic. And yes, it has people wearing hyper-realistic masks. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 was directed by Christopher McQuarrie and is in theaters starting tomorrow. With all that said, Weyland Wong, what did you think?
I had a fantastic time at this movie. This is my favorite action franchise, and it's number one in my heart, I think because it's so consistent. I was trying to think of another franchise that is just so consistent in terms of quality and delivering pure entertainment. And I think it's just Toy Story and Mission Impossible for me at this point. And I just was really enraptured by a lot of the action sequences, which I think is the big draw for me and a lot of other people. It does run a little long, but I didn't feel it because I was having so much fun, especially at the end. There's this extended set piece on a train.
That part's awesome.
And I was so immersed in it that at one point I involuntarily yelled, "Oh no," just really loud, which my husband said was his favorite part of the movie is when I yelled, "Oh no."
I actually, during that, I several times went, "Yup." Yup. Nice. Like the next thing, you're like, yup.
And so it's just one of those movies that sucks you in. It makes you feel really excited. It gets your blood pumping. So I really loved it. I mean, obviously, caveats always. I did not love the killer AI angle, I think, because I'm still burned out from all of the dangerous AI we've encountered in pop culture. I haven't even recovered from Westworld yet. I'm still feeling the tedium of the killer AI in that series. So not so much into the villain, but I did really like Issa Morales as the human villain. And I really loved Hayley Atwell. I thought she had really nice chemistry, incredible bone structure. I was mesmerized.
Yeah. All right. How about you, Roxana? What'd you think?
I also am a major Mission Impossible fan. I think these movies are fun and goofy, and I appreciate that with every film. Given that, I do think this falls slightly lower than Fallout for me, which I think is like the pinnacle of all around hot cast, all around absurd stunts. But this was enjoyable. I think overall the tone is like more solemn than I would anticipate from a Mission Impossible movie. Yeah. I think the AI is treated with like sort of a funny amount of distance. Like it's both like really evil and also like it's just an AI. I had a good time. I just sort of wish, I don't know, I almost wish this had just been one six-hour movie with an intermission. I really loved that. But I think it ends in a place that really makes me want to see the second one. And that's really all you could ask from these like movies that are split into two parts is, do I care about seeing the second one? And I do.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it. Chris Klimek, I know you are also a Mission Impossible franchise fan. How did this one hit you?
This one is a step down. I mean, like, I do think this has become my favorite franchise in my favorite genre. The four-film run that begins with Mission Impossible 3 in 2006. I really cannot think of another franchise that has produced four films in a row as strong as 3, Ghost Protocol, Rogue Nation, and Fallout. So I come into this with wildly inflated expectations that this film didn't meet. The crazy, chaotic process that produces these movies, it's just like the Impossible Mission Force on one of their wild missions where the mask machine breaks down, you know, so now we have to do this. I enjoy that sort of meta level to them in the same way that to my mind, these movies have only gotten more enjoyable as the border between Tom Cruise, actor, movie star, and Tom Cruise, crazy stuntman, has gotten thinner and thinner to the point where I absolutely believe it when Tom Cruise is climbing the Burj Khalifa or hanging off the side of an airplane in flight. And if he tried to play a regular guy with a regular job, I probably wouldn't buy it.
Right. And I do want to say, like, one thing that happened during this movie was that I got really sad when all of a sudden I realized that Tom Cruise used to do a lot more different things. Yeah. And basically, like, once he started doing this franchise, like rom-com Tom Cruise and comedy Tom Cruise and like dramatic acting Tom Cruise, the one who was in Magnolia.
Three-time Oscar nominee Tom Cruise. Yes.
Like, he kind of just quit everything else for the most part, except like action blockbusters. And to me, that's like slightly sad.
I think it's just that, you know, this is a guy who's very worried about market share. You know, he is not willing to be in movies that are just good and not a lot of people see them, right? The weirdness about Tom Cruise and his lady co-stars that I know we're going to talk about is a direct response to the fact that the audience decided about 15 years ago, we don't like Tom Cruise kissing anymore. You know, we're just going to elide all of that.
That's interesting and strange.
I mean, Mission Impossible 3 is a terrific movie that kind of bombed relative to the expectations for the series. And that coincided with, you know, jumping on the couch and all of the extra movie-related stuff that sort of cut into the public's affection for Tom Cruise in a big way. And so I don't think he, you know, back when he was starting his career and he was like, I'm going to work with Coppola, I'm going to work with Scorsese, I'm going to work with Barry Levinson, I'm going to work with all the best directors in the game, Kubrick. I don't think he said, and then I'm going to hit my mid-40s and only make action movies. That's what the market will still accept from him.
But like, don't you think it's also that it's what he enjoys doing? He has fun doing this.
Yeah.
He wants to jump motorcycles.
Absolutely. And I mean, like in the same way that James Cameron is like, I want to dive to the Titanic, but I don't want to pay for it. You know, how can I get a movie studio to underwrite this for me? Right. I think it's part of that.
Yeah. But I feel like at a certain point, if we're having like a larger market conversation, I don't think that's just a Tom Cruise thing. I think there are actors of a certain older age who have found this like action movie avenue that they stick to. Basically, what I'm saying is don't come for Tom Cruise, Chris.
No. It's really me that's coming for Tom Cruise. And I will say it's less coming for Tom Cruise and it's more like I just miss all the other stuff Tom Cruise isn't doing. It's less that I don't think these are good. I do think they're good. But Chris, if you had to sum up like what made this a step down for you, what do you think it is?
This movie, it feels like they left all the exposition in, like all of the sort of boring connective tissue of how we got here and how we got this. You know, this is the assembly cut. If this did not have finished visual effects and finished scoring and stuff, I'd be like, well, they're going to take 25 minutes out of this, right? And no, it's all here. And it's just really awkwardly paced and weird.
You know, what's interesting is Macquarie has also talked about those shots where the characters are just reciting these Wikipedia articles about the MacGuffin. He always shoots them like in tight close-up and kind of a bland background, right? Because that makes it easier to cut later and to kind of figure out what to do with all those more boring pieces later. And I agree with you, Chris, that the Wikipedia scenes just went on entirely too long for me. There's that extended scene in some sit room in the White House or at the Pentagon or something where they're just going around and around and around in a circle explaining the AI. Yeah. And if there was a point in the movie where I might have checked my watch, even though I didn't, it would have been there because I just was like, when are we going to be done with the ritualistic reading of the Wikipedia article and just on with more Tom Cruise running or whatever?
I just find a godlike AI a difficult villain to build a movie around.
Agreed.
And it's simply too powerful. And you allow the villain to kind of shapeshift to any situation to be able to defeat the hero in a new way in any situation. And one of the reasons why people like, you know, Hans Gruber in Die Hard or even some of the other villains in this very series is that when it's a person, it feels palpable and you can feel the conflict more and you can feel the fight more. I mean, look, Isai Morales is not only an actor I've been watching and enjoying for decades, but also one of Hollywood's truly handsome men. But
oh my goodness,
handsome.
Yes.
My God.
You know, to not objectify people, really good in this movie. And yes. I like him, but I think expecting him to kind of stand in for this basically supernatural, you're essentially getting to the point where you're fighting secular God. And that to me is a tough conflict to make tactile. And that's my big problem with this movie, because I think when you look at the set pieces, there's a stretch in an airport, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. There's a car chase, which I think is great. The section that takes place on the train is fabulous. Loved it. Laughed. Shouted.
But Linda, I agree. I missed what this franchise normally does, which is just like bad guy who has thing to sell, which is sort of what this movie also is. It's like the AI is within the keys and they need the key because people are fighting over it. And of course, the American government wants it. It's like that. But there's an additional layer with it being the AI that I think is unnecessary and sort of convoluted and does lead to those long scenes where people are just like, wait, how does the AI work?
Well, at the end of this screening, I was sitting with our producer, Mike Katzeff, and Mike turned to me and said, I think if I hear the words the entity or the key one more time, they're going to lose all meaning, because you do eventually just feel like you've had it explained to you 400 times. Like, we don't know what the key unlocked. I don't know. Waylon, how did the villainy work for you?
Yeah, you know, I think that villains have never really been this series' strong suit. I've always been underwhelmed by... Yeah, that's... I don't know if that's a controversial opinion.
No, Philip Seymour Hoffman is spinning in his grave, Waylon.
No, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman. I love the villain in 3. Mm. I love the villain in 2. I feel like number 2, it gets unfairly maligned. That's actually very high up on my ranking. I love Mission Impossible 2 with Dougray Scott. But I've been a little bit underwhelmed by some of the Macquarie villains. And I also found the AI here to be kind of perfunctory. I feel like you're moving through a list of objects that, when in the wrong hands, are going to cause world destruction. And they've already done virus. They've already done various permutations of nukes and big right. weapons. And so I think, like, killer AI is just the next thing that they pluck off of their Mad Libs list. And so that felt a little perfunctory to me. And so I wish they had leaned out of the killer AI and out of the key stuff and just more into Issa Morales' character, Gabriel, as a person, because they set up a little bit of a backstory where you know they have history together, they're longtime nemeses. And then you think about Issa Morales and Tom Cruise coming up together in the industry and their paths having diverged very sharply in terms of levels of stardom. There's an interesting aura to that pairing that I would have liked to see brought out more. Instead, Issa Morales kind of pops up every once in a while, but otherwise, it's a lot of tedious discussion of the key and the entity. So I didn't enjoy that so much.
All of the setup around explaining the AI really slows down the movie and slows down getting to one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is the introduction of the Hayley Atwell character. I do have beefs with the general way that brunettes in this franchise are sort of picked up and then dismissed and replaced with new ones. And so I'm always a little bit suspicious of, like, here's the new woman who Tom Cruise meets and she's spunky and has great skills and what will happen when they meet and collide and all that. But I do think Hayley Atwell is great in this.
Yeah.
As I said, I don't necessarily need to see everybody suddenly obsessed with doing close-up magic, but...
Oh, I liked it. I would have used 50% more close-up magic.
That's awesome.
I wanted Tom Cruise to pull a core out of Hayley Atwell's ear at some point.
And that's another one of those things where it just does not really surprise you at all that Cruise can do this. And he does it in the first one, right? He does it with the disc in the scene with Jean Reno,
I feel a way about some of it, but I do like Hayley Atwell, and the car chase that the two of them are in together is wonderful. It's one of my favorite sequences in the whole franchise. And so is the train. So, like, there's plenty in this movie to love. I just felt like it was held together with an extraordinarily flimsy and boring underlying story.
The car chase is the only one that has the kind of whimsy that you get in some of the other movies. Like the Burj Khalifa climb in Ghost Protocol, that is one of the greatest stunts in the history of cinema, but it's also funny. Like, it's when the broken glove flies past his face.
The train is funny.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. I think Fallout took the intensity, the dire tone, the serialization in the series about as far as I want it to go. Like, I don't want it to go deeper into any of these things, which is what this film, Dead Reckoning, does. But things in like in Ghost Protocol, when Simon Pegg and Cruise are sneaking into the Kremlin and they're setting up this dumb projector.
So funny.
Right.
I just recently rewatched that. We didn't get an infiltration scene in this one. I'm hoping for one in the second.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, Tom Cruise and Hayley Atwell trying to do a car chase in a ridiculously tiny car while they're handcuffed together. That's great, you know, but that's the only one of these that has that kind of humor.
I think that it was funny enough. But I again just think this comes down to being like a villain problem. When I think about what I love about Fallout, it's like we determine, spoiler alert, I guess, if you haven't seen Fallout, we determine that like Henry Cavill is a bad guy, the CIA is antagonistic. There are a lot of different layers of baddies in that film, which I think like maintains a certain amount of tension throughout and a certain amount of humor as we try to figure out like, is Henry Cavill's character just a jerk because he's a jerk or because he's nefarious, right? So like there's more there.
Is the mustache controlling him somehow?
Right. I mean, the mustache is like the best he's ever looked. So shout out to that mustache. But I think in this, like, I almost wanted the AI to go like full Matrix and start like activating more baddies or something. Like, I agree with Linda that like the villain was so high up there that at certain points, I think the things on the ground, the way that these characters were interacting with each other just felt off. Like, it's a little weird to me that we don't get like a Simon Pegg doing something funny sequence, which isn't to say Simon Pegg should always be funny, but he's pretty good at it.
Yeah.
But most of the time in this film, he's just at like a certain level of despair. So I think there were just certain things about it that felt off tonally and pacing wise. And I think it just comes back to the villain being too big. So like, I liked the magic. I thought it was funny, but it's like, we're doing magic in a movie about an AI villain. Like there were certain things about it that just felt disjointed to me, but I'm willing to forgive a lot because of the train sequence. And we're not even talking about the motorcycle jump, which is like the big stunt that they have hyped for like months, releasing tons of videos about how it was done. So I think all of that stuff is great. There are certain parts of it throughout where I was like, something about this feels weird.
Yeah. I mean, if I rewatch this movie, basically everything that's not stunts and action, I will just fast forward through because it's not charming enough to me. Also, like, Ving Rhames has gotten very, like, philosophical.
Everyone is so philosophical. Yes.
Yeah.
But, like, his character in particular, I feel like, has gotten really, like, heavy, making these kind of portentous pronouncements about things.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait, is this what Luther was always like? I don't know.
Maybe when you name your film Dead Reckoning, there's like no way back to being funny. Yeah. Maybe it's just too dark.
Speaking of the longevity of this series and how long we've been watching these characters and just this whole franchise unfold, I actually was thinking a lot about mentorship during this film. Is Mission Impossible actually like a workplace drama? I don't know. We can point counterpoint. But anyway, I was thinking about mentorship because, you know, Ethan has mentored younger IMF agents before. If you think about Kerry Russell in 3, or the way he mentored Benji. Remember, Benji did not start in the field, but then gets to be a field agent. And then there's a scene with the young agent at the start of this film where it's like the first time the guy's delivered one of these exploding messages. So he's really nervous, but Tom Cruise, you know, coaches him through it. And then I was thinking about that awesome car chase with Hayley Atwell when they're handcuffed. And he is also giving her instructions about how to drive in the car chase because she ends up in the driver's seat and she's not as confident behind the wheel as he is. I realized it's like he's teaching her how to be an action hero. And then in the Tom Cruise brand of being an action hero, and then I kind of zoomed out and thought about, is Tom Cruise in this stage of his career passing on the institutional knowledge he's built up about how to make a blockbuster? And you're watching him teach a younger actor how to do these stunts, kind of, and you're watching it unfold on screen. And then also I was thinking about Top Gun Maverick, which is literally about Tom Cruise teaching the next generation of fighter pilots how to be Maverick. And so then I'm like, are we watching our last kind of old-fashioned movie star of a particular ilk passing on institutional knowledge of how to make a blockbuster? Does that mean that these Mission Impossible films are actually about the impossible mission of filmmaking? And I think it's an interesting choice for Tom Cruise to be dedicating so much of his life and, you know, risking his life basically to make these movies for us. It's like, I think at one point I'm like, what if Tom Cruise dies making a Mission Impossible movie? I feel like that's like a question we have to ask ourselves. Is this going to happen?
Different action movies have done this. Like, I think the last Bad Boys was also very much like this, where it's like, here's the new class and we're like handing it off. But I like that Cruise has done like back-to-back movies with that point. And I think that's a smart one to end on. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we want to know what you think about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Waylon Wong, Chris Klimek, Roxana Haddadi, thank you so much for being here to talk about this movie.
Thank you.
Yay, thank you.
Yay, thank you.
One last thing before we go. Speaking of big movies, the upcoming Barbie and Oppenheimer face-off at the box office got us thinking about some of our favorite pop culture matchups, and we want your votes on what's better. Think Batman versus Superman, Britney versus Christina. You'll hear the results in an upcoming episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can find a link to the survey in our show notes. This episode was produced by Mike Katziff and Hafsa Fathma and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, We want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.